This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a regional update on Iraq, Syria, and the growing role of Iran in both countries. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On the 16th anniversary of the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq that ousted Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, that nation's political and economic landscape continues to be marked by competition for influence between the United States and Iran. And much to the dismay of Washington, Tehran is gaining ground. Iranian armed forces assisted Iraq in ousting the so-called Islamic State from its territory after a devastating three-year war against the extremist group. The two countries share a 900-mile border and are home to Shiite Muslim-majority populations, helping create closer ties between them since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Currently, Iran is seeking to boost economic links with Iraq, in part to circumvent U.S. sanctions that came into effect after Washington withdrew from the JCPOA, or Iranian Nuclear Agreement. Recently, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani met with Iraqi Prime Minister Abdel Abdul Mahdi in Baghdad to discuss joint economic projects, including ways to keep Iranian natural gas flowing to Iraq, a development which greatly displeases Washington. Moreover, Iran was the real winner of last year's parliamentary elections in Iraq. The parties linked to the paramilitary popular mobilization forces, most of them with ties to Tehran, emerged as kingmakers. In short, Iran has insinuated itself into Iraqi political life and the military, and now seeks to expand economically and culturally. The state of affairs in Syria also looks rather bleak for U.S. interests, in part because of policy choices made under the Obama administration since the 2011 popular peaceful uprising against the rule of President Bashar al-Assad, and now under the Trump administration. Many analysts say President Obama underestimated the staying power of Assad and did not do enough in concert with Western allies to support the civilian and rebel opposition. In late December 2018, U.S. President Donald Trump had announced he intended to remove all 2,000 U.S. troops in that country, saying that ISIS, the so-called Islamic State or Daesh, was mostly defeated, a move which prompted former Defense Secretary General Jim Mattis to resign. Since then, the administration has backtracked and decided to leave a residual force of approximately 400 troops. Today, after nearly 8 years of conflict, Assad is on the verge of victory. His forces have clawed back control over much of the country with the help of Russian air power and Iranian-backed foreign militias. Even though President Trump decided to keep a residual force of U.S. troops in Syria, it may not be enough to counter Russia and Iran, let alone prevent the reemergence of the Islamic State. Joining us to analyze the state of affairs in Iraq and Syria, as well as the growing role of Iran in both countries, are Barbara Leaf. She's the former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. She's a distinguished foreign service officer, and now she is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank here in Washington. And Ellen Lapson, she's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. And that's a college in the nearby state of Virginia. Previously, she served as CEO of the Stimson Center, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. The ladies join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, Ambassador Leaf, let me begin with you. Welcome to the program. Let's take a quick look at the long-term impact of this U.S.-led invasion 16 years ago. How would you assess Iraq politically and economically on this 16th anniversary?
You know, without relitigating the issues of 2003, I think the period of the last 15 to 17 years has been one of constant tumult and strife and internal disarray much of the time due to all of the dynamics that were unleashed with the invasion and certainly how the U.S. administered the state in the years succeeding. However, that said, we have to now look at Iraq through a very different prism because Iraqis have agency and sovereignty to a degree and in a measure that they simply didn't enjoy through 2011.
So, Ellen Lapson, they have a certain amount of sovereignty and agency now, but not the kind that perhaps the United States is very happy about, based on the fact that there's quite an affinity with Iran, notwithstanding Iran is Persian, and of course, Iraq is an Arab country, but the Shia connection. How do you see the current state of play, especially with the Shia parties in the lead and its affinity with Iran?
So I think Ambassador Leaf's point about Iraq having agency is very important. This is now a country that's plotting its own destiny, and it's a messy picture to watch. It's tumultuous and sometimes not very peaceful looking, but in fact, there is this drumbeat towards a more contestational representative system. There's corruption, there's many problems. We may not like the geopolitics, but the truth is Iraq was always intrinsically important because it was a bridge between Iran and the Arab world. So that's just a geographic reality. There's no policy from Washington or any other external capital that's going to change that fundamental truth. So I think given the fact that Iraq is now a more independent actor and setting its own foreign policy, I don't think the story is exclusively negative. I think that we, a little bit with our help, but mostly with Iraqi action, they are reintegrating into the Arab world, and they are balancing what is obviously a very deep interdependent economic relationship with Iran, and yet setting some boundaries and limits to how far Iranian influence can go inside the country.
So back to you, Ambassador Leaf. With respect to the ties between Iran and Iraq, a policy now that is trying to contain Iran's rise in the region, and that conflicts with Iraq's priorities. In fact, there are also differences within the administration. You have the U.S. State Department under Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who wants to go further, possibly even designate some Iraqi militias with Iranian backing as terrorist organizations. They are trying to prevent Iraq from buying natural gas from Iran, which they need, and President Trump wanted U.S. troops to keep an eye on Iran from Iraq, and all of these things antagonized Iraq. So what do you make of not just the internal differences within the U.S. administration, but also these differences between Iraq and the United States over the role of Iran?
Let me take a few things in order, and I want to put aside the notion, or I want to contest the notion, that you've got a lot of disagreement as such between institutions within the administration, as opposed to perhaps concerns within the government as to how full and fleshed out a strategy for Iraq really is, and whether one stands alone from the Iran piece, which is almost exclusively sanctions defined. So on Iraq, I think you have to look at a couple of different things. You said that Iraq's priorities are different from our own. I actually think there's a good deal of overlap between Washington and Baghdad, or U.S. and Iraq, in terms of a couple of really fundamental things. And that is Iraq recovering from the terrible destruction of really 4 years of combat to pull itself back from the brink under the onslaught of ISIS. So recovery, which also means economic recovery, which brings with it a greater degree to chart its own destiny, full sovereignty, to be able to chart a neutral kind of foreign policy. And you hear Iraqi leaders say this, that they don't want to be drawn into the region's conflicts, and they don't want to be drawn into the U.S.-Iran conflict. But we have an overlap with the Iraqi government in its desire to really achieve stability, prosperity, economic growth, and full sovereignty over its decisions. I would argue it does not as yet enjoy fullest sovereignty in the sense of what I can only describe as a fairly predatory set of foreign policy and trade policies exercised by Tehran.
So back to you, Alan, for your take on the U.S. policy toward Iraq, particularly with respect to Iran's role, because there are some points of divergence in addition to the points of convergence that Ambassador Leaf spoke about.
So I think we're in a rough patch right now in relations with Iraq, and I think that part of it is our own style of overstating what we want without necessarily having either coordinated or listened carefully to where the Iraqis are politically. So I think the president's singular focus on it's all about ISIS or Iran. I know who the enemies of the U.S. are, and that's what I'm going to focus on. But having a somewhat utilitarian concept of his relations with what he perceives as, of course, weaker countries that should be very compliant with American demands. And I think it's really backfired. I think that, unfortunately, it stimulated a big debate in the Iraqi parliament about whether the terms and conditions for an American presence in the country are unacceptable. So it's actually parallel to Afghanistan, where the talks with the Taliban are a little bit about, is the American presence still legitimate? Is there still a legal and politically accepted basis for American presence in these countries? So, you know, we have a reasonably moderate Iraqi government now, with the prime minister and the president being quite fair-minded people who are trying to balance relations with Washington and Iran. But they're now grappling with a wellspring of anti-American sentiment, particularly among Shia politicians, but not exclusively Shia politicians, saying the Americans are just trying to use us for their own purposes, and we get to define what kind of relationship we want to have with Tehran. I think it could have been handled with much greater subtlety and deft on the part of Washington.
Well, back to you before we go to a break, Ambassador Leaf, on Iraq, because it looks like the Shia dominance, by sheer virtue of the population in Iraq, which is 60% Shia Muslims with Sunnis and the Kurds ethnic groups, but because of this dominance, this is a permanent feature of Iraqi politics, and by virtue of their proximity with Iran, they are naturally going to look to Iran for trade and other kinds of ties. So how will the United States, because of its desire to contain Iran, to have everybody in the region somehow isolate Iran, how is that going to play out to the U.S. benefit?
I think we have to take our minds off this single-minded focus on sanctions vis-a-vis Iran. That's a starting point. And we have to craft a policy towards Iraq that is about Iraq, that is about the bilateral relationship and the enormous good that we can bring to that relationship. Things that we can bring to the relationship, by the way, that Iran cannot for a variety of structural, cultural, and frankly, financial reasons. Yes, it's actually a good thing if Iran and Iraq have a normal relationship. They should have one. Let's not go back to the 1980s. Let's not go back to a period of time when they saw each other as existential threats. It would be good for no one. They've got a 1,400-kilometer border. They've got historical ties. But I think we should also not focus monomaniacally on the issue of Iraq's demographics somehow determining its fate. In fact, we should not ourselves as Americans fall into that trap and look at this development of state-to-state relations between big Sunni neighbors, important Sunni neighbors, and this Shia-dominated country. That's a good thing. That's what we want to encourage, whether between Amman and Baghdad or Cairo and Baghdad, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi and Baghdad.
Well, that's a very good point. And back to you before we go to a break, Ellen, because notwithstanding the Shia dominance in Iraq, we have Sunni communities, Kurdish communities, and the Sunni communities are still feeling resentment based on the fact that the Iranian-backed Shia militias were responsible primarily for routing ISIS. And they also, in many ways, tried to demonize these Sunni communities, trying to associate them with ISIS. So what about the Sunni communities and the future of U.S.-Iraqi relations?
Very quickly on the Sunni thing, I do think that the reconciliation within Iraq is a generational project. I think there are currently Iraqi political leaders who are trying to gently move that along. They need some prominent Shia politicians to join in that effort. But I think that's an Iraqi endeavor. And I think if the United States to try to get too involved in the internal, because these are socio-cultural, religious issues, not just issues of legal representation in institutions. It's much deeper than that. But I'd like to just make sure that we understand that what Ambassador Leaf and I are suggesting is a reasonable American strategy for the region, which is to try to diffuse sources of tension, reduce the prospects for conflict, etc., is not exactly the way the current administration is thinking. The current administration, I think, sees the world in kind of black and white terms, and it's the, are you with us or against us? And they really do want to press the Sunni Arab states to be part of an anti-Iran coalition. Some Arab countries are enthusiastic about that concept in principle. We still don't know how far they're really willing to go if things were to get more confrontational with Iran. But we're representing a view that is a responsible role for the United States is to try to work with all parties and diffuse prospects for conflict. But in fact, the Iran strategy of the current administration is really making a very different demand of our Arab friends in the region.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Barbara Leaf, former U.S. ambassador to the UAE. She's now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And Ellen Lapson, former president of the Stimson Center, now professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. We're evaluating the current state of affairs in Iraq and soon in Syria, and examining the growing role of Iran in both countries. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also obtain it via iTunes. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Hadi Milani from Tehran. If you want to hear your name on the air, send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, in the few minutes we have left, Ambassador Leaf, let's go to Syria. It seems it's almost as if it's like an inverse situation. We have the rise of Iran, Russia, two adversaries, and we have two scourges. We have the brutal despot Bashar al-Assad. He was able to cling to power thanks to help from Iranian militias, Hezbollah from Russia. And even though the so-called Islamic State is almost defeated territorially, they still have sleeper cells and the ideology is still potent. So here's the question. If containing Iran is a major policy priority for Washington, even if people disagree with the way it's being implemented, how do you reconcile the fact that Tehran is one of the major beneficiaries of American retrenchment in Syria? How can the United States be comfortable with that?
I can't reconcile that, and I don't think the administration has reconciled that. And in fact, the president's unilateral decision, against the advice of all of his senior advisors, members of the cabinet, etc., and against the advice of close foreign partners, his decision to announce the withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Syria really gutted what was a nascent and could have been a fairly effective piece of policymaking towards Syria. Syria is a place of exquisite geopolitical complexity, and I think the president's move simply threw away all the leverage that we had, left Syria in the hands of external actors who have really ransacked the place, and was announced really well before we were even close to the final finishing flourishes of the battle to take back territory from ISIS.
So, Ellen, the same question to you. How do you reconcile this retrenchment on the part of the United States, the withdrawal of troops, notwithstanding a residual force, and the desire to counter Iran, because this very action has helped to bolster Iran?
Well, I think when the president almost impulsively, after a conversation with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan, said, oh, goody, I've got a neighbor, a partner I can trust, I can now leave, it was almost an impulsive response, forgetting that there's, as Ambassador Leaf said, amazing complexity to how many different things are going on in Syria at any given time. We haven't even mentioned Israel. I mean, there's multiple dynamics to how U.S. interests will be affected by how this war ends and who's ruling what parts of Syria. So we're probably seeing a decentralized country that has some pockets that will remain only loosely tethered to the government in Damascus. So I think the president almost forgot his Iran policy when he made the decision to pull out. My worry now is that he has slightly compromised with this notion of a token American presence of 200 troops. I don't envy the military commander of those troops. That's way too small a number to be able to defend itself. So whether Iran wants to see an opportunity here, let's hope not. But it's almost below the threshold of symbolic and effective presence. I think the U.S. military doesn't believe that that small a presence will actually allow them to achieve much in the way of blocking any Iranian incursions or being able to work very successfully with the parties on the ground.
Indeed. Well, those parties on the ground is what we're going to talk about next. It seems as if the United States and the West have, to some extent, given up on countering the, in my view at least, the equally brutal Bashar al-Assad regime in favor on focusing on the defeat of the so-called Islamic State, which captured a lot of territory. But, of course, as you both said, with fewer U.S. troops, that's going to be much more difficult. And the United States is now counting more and more on their allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces, dominated by Kurdish fighters, and they're not happy about the U.S. withdrawal of troops because that makes them vulnerable to Turkey, because Turkey perceives the Kurds as enemies for domestic internal reasons. And of course, that complicates the goal of eradicating once and for all the so-called Islamic State. How are Turkey's political calculations, Ambassador Leaf, in all of this, their rapprochement with Russia and accommodation of their former foe, Bashar al-Assad, either helping or undermining U.S. goals in Syria?
Well, you put your finger on some really critical pieces of the puzzle. And I agree with Ellen. When the president made this decision, I don't think he was thinking about Iran. I think he was thinking single-mindedly about a campaign promise, a commitment he'd made to bring troops home, and also his own personal aversion to deploying U.S. forces abroad, or perhaps his belief that there's really no good to come of it. In any case, in no way did he then, or did the belated tack back to saying, well, we'll leave a couple of hundred troops in place. In no way did any of this address what is really unique about Syria, which is it's not just about Syria. As you say, this is a question of how Turkey is morphing and drifting in its relationship away increasingly from its own NATO partners towards Moscow, who is no friend of anyone, certainly no friend of the United States. The issue of Bashar to stay or go, you could say that issue has already been settled and was unlikely to be moved by what the U.S. was doing. But we might have been able to, again, use the leverage that our troop presence brought if we were working effectively with Turkey against the territory that it was controlling. Together, that was about 40% of Syria's landmass. The question of reconstruction aid, there were lots of cards to play because ultimately, this is about Syria, but it's not only about Syria. And by the way, ultimately, if we just pull out, the SDF cannot on its own at this state contend with the resurgence of ISIS, and nor can any other partner there, certainly not the Turks, certainly not Assad. So the potential for enormous blowback into Iraq is there.
There you go, tying it all together. To you, Ellen, with respect to the SDF dominated by the Kurdish fighters, to what extent are they going to be more concerned about what Turkey might do to them as opposed to their attempts to defeat the remnants of ISIS on their own behalf and on behalf of the United States?
I think the SDF are in a very precarious position right now. They were feeling triumphant that they had an amazing relationship with the United States, that the trends were going in their favor, but there is always the danger that they're very ideological, that they'll overplay their hand. And the Iraqi Kurds have been telling the Syrian Kurds recently, dial it back a little bit, and maybe you need to talk to Damascus. You need to prepare for a post-American partnership. You need to imagine what's life going to be like if the Americans leave. So even there, we may have lost, and it's certainly not the first time in history that the United States had a kind of tactical alliance with Kurdish groups and then walked away when circumstances changed. So it's yet another example, I think, of how the Kurds have to consider some other options at this juncture.
So back to you, Ambassador Leaf. Is our policy, both with respect to Iraq and Syria, that is the U.S. policy, in a sense inadvertently serving to bolster the rise of Iran in the region rather than actually deterring it? And the same with Russia, which is on the rise and seeing itself now as a rising global power.
I think in the short term, that's definitely true. And look, both Russia and Iran have endemic long-term structural weaknesses, economic, demographic, and the rest, the nature of their own political systems. But in the short term, both sets of leaderships are pretty brilliant at divining and exploiting opportunities, vacuums, what have you. And they will continue to do so where we offer them those opportunities. So yes, in the short term, that's true. In the long term, it's quite a different picture. And I'm particularly optimistic about Iraq in those terms.
You get the final word, Ellen.
So I agree that we shouldn't exaggerate Russia's rise in the region. Russia is very limited in terms of what kinds of power and whether it has soft power and whether it attracts the countries in the region. For now, they're just enjoying this game of chess with the United States, and it looks like it's in their favor. Iran is a slightly more complicated story because I think Iran does have some assets. They're a major regional power, whether we're there or not. And that, again, brings us back to a broader theme of would it not be in U.S. interest to envision the region where Iran and the Arab states had a modus vivendi rather than this brinksmanship of expecting somehow the United States to come in and solve the problem through kinetic means, if you will. I don't think that's a desirable future for the region.
We'll certainly continue our conversation on Iraq and Syria in the months ahead. But for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ambassador Barbara Leaf. She's former U.S. Ambassador to the UAE, now Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And Ellen Lapson, she's Professor and Director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. Ladies, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Cornelius Tanner. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.